Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guests today are education reporters covering a back-to-school season like no other. As districts wrestle with what education will look like in the fall, reporters have been digging into the minutiae of reopening plans, remote instruction, and how families are responding. Also, beyond the day-to-day, they're looking ahead and how this disruption in education will affect those students who are already struggling. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you on this. What's important for journalists to keep in mind as they cover education? What do you want them to understand about what's happening in your districts? As always, we welcome your questions. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Sarah Gibson, NHPR's education reporter, and Anya Kamenetz, education correspondent at NPR. Well, a big welcome to both of you. And Anya, I want to start with you. You've been writing that what we're seeing now with education is part of a broader trend that you've actually covered for a long time that you call education disruption. What do you mean by that, Anya? Give us a little more, please.
Sure. I mean, you know, education obviously is always a reflection of the times that we live in and the economics that we live in. But the disruption that's happened comes from, you know, economic disruption, the globalization of the economy, changes in people's belief in the relevance of education, as well as the way that technology have changed how education is delivered. Now, up until the past year or so, there's been a lot of impact and sway of online education in the higher ed space, but it's really only with this incredible disruption of the pandemic that we saw, you know, remote learning coming to K-12 as well, and with similar kinds of impacts actually that we've seen in higher ed for years now.
It's interesting what you say. I've heard so many leaders in all sorts of fields, you know, business and nonprofits and so forth, Anya, say, in part, the pandemic has only accelerated trends that were already underway. Would you agree with that, Anya?
In some ways, absolutely. You know, we've had really decades of struggling to close achievement gaps or ameliorate inequities in education. They've been very stubborn by race and by class, and that has just been so exacerbated by this pandemic. We see that there are, you know, millions of children across the country that don't have access to good infrastructure as far as broadband, computers, that don't have someone at home that can reliably help them with learning. And so remote learning is just what one person calls a force multiplier for inequalities that unfortunately have persisted in our system for a very long time.
Wow. Well, Sarah, what does the disruption look like in New Hampshire? I'm guessing it's similar to what Anya's saying.
Yeah, it is. You know, in the very early parts of the statewide school closure in March, we heard a lot about people kind of pivoting to blizzard bag type of models, which is what we used to have in snow days when schools would occasionally be closed. And then, you know, there were a lot of online platforms and programs, companies that offered their online learning platforms for free for at least a number of months. And a lot of districts took advantage of that. So we saw in the pivot to online learning, a bunch of teachers and districts experimenting with different online platforms, some of which are free, some of which are no longer free. And so districts have tried to figure out this summer, like, do we now start paying, you know, that monthly fee in order to have access to online learning platforms, which, as we know, are already pretty popular among higher ed.
Wow. And reflect too, Sarah, if you could please, on what Anya said. Many people have said that remote learning has only increased the divide between the education haves and the have-nots. In what way have you seen this or heard about this, Sarah, in New Hampshire?
I think it permeates every conversation, and it's certainly on the minds of school leaders as well as state officials when they think about how to reopen and how to address what has been a growing inequity in New Hampshire in terms of student outcomes, particularly along racial lines. We hear about students with special ed needs who were already struggling in traditional in-person classes, really falling behind and probably needing a fair amount of compensatory education programming this fall if they return to school. We also, heard stories of people whose parents were essential workers, maybe custodians at hospitals, maybe, grocery workers. And they were essentially raising their younger siblings and overseeing the remote learning of several younger siblings while at home and trying to do their own work in high school remotely. So there were a lot of people who just lacked the parental oversight, which we know from the spring was so important in order for kids to not fall behind. So there certainly are conversations now about how to get some of those kids back into the school, even if in general school buildings are closed. There's discussion about cohorts of English language learners as well as special ed students who would be in the school and in places like Concord, Manchester, Somersworth, and Dover, which are all starting remote.
Wow. And Sarah, by the way, your job has just been, let's just say, incredibly complicated lately because every district has a different plan. You just rattled off a couple names of districts there that are all approaching this differently. So how hard has this been for you to keep track of, Sarah?
It's not easy. Not only does every we have more than 100 districts. So every district has its own plan. They're developing their own metric for when it's safe to transition from, say, hybrid to fully in person, back to, remote should there be an outbreak. In addition to having developed all those plans, districts have had to change them. There certainly has been, pushback in some communities with the initial plan. So what we thought was going to happen in late July has actually been radically transformed by mid-August because of community input. And, some proposals also met with a lot of concern and consternation from teachers unions. So a lot of districts have had to go back to the drawing board or at least modify their plans. So it's definitely a full-time job just to kind of get a sense of where districts are at. And they also, as they hear about neighboring districts and those plans, they're sometimes having to modify because often, a teacher will teach in one district but have their kids elsewhere. So if the teacher's kids are all going to be in a remote learning model, but they're being asked to teach in person at their district, that introduces a whole other set of questions. So some districts are trying to coordinate better with one another in a regional way so that there's some consistency geographically.
Sure. And Anya, I'd love your thoughts, too, on this evolution that Sarah touches on. She's right. The plans that districts were talking about in July have changed in August, and it's kind of creating parental whiplash, really. But the schools are just responding to case numbers and new concerns. What have you seen in terms of the way that districts have evolved with their planning over the summer, Anya?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of what Sarah is speaking to has to do with the uniqueness of our system here in the United States with over 13,000 school districts across the country. And, the sort of unusual lack of national leadership in this country in response to the pandemic leads to unclear guidelines, which then have to be interpreted by local officials to the best of their abilities. And all of that really leads cumulatively to a huge amount of uncertainty, and I think that what I'm hearing from parents and teachers right now is that the uncertainty is becoming toxic in and of itself, in that, we all want to represent to our children the importance of resilience and flexibility and having a growth mindset and responding to challenges. But the truth is that not knowing what's going to happen and not being able to plan for, the next few weeks, let alone the next few months or the entire school year, is really wearing on people and is becoming a source of stress all on its own, separate from, the stress the pandemic itself is bringing.
Wow, toxic uncertainty. And it has been tough for districts to make these decisions. Anya, people are exhausted, people are scared, people are working with this constantly changing landscape in terms of the virus. How does that affect district decision making, Anya? We're not bringing our best selves to the table here.
Well, you know, I think there's just so many factors here. But one thing that I've observed is, of course, having to have meetings over Zoom, you know, right. makes it harder for people to come together and forge a common understanding. You know, information coming out on social media, obviously people, you know, wanting to protect themselves and protect each other with very good intentions, but there's a huge amount of pressure on local decision makers, again, without always the clearest instructions coming from above, which makes it much harder for them to respond. And I think that's, you know, I see examples of this in New York City and in Fairfax, Virginia, and other places around the country where, you know, one plan will be put forward, there'll be a huge backlash and pressure, and then they'll pivot to something else. And that just leaves people even more confused.
We got an email from Rick toward that end who says, some schools appear to be using parents' opinion and preference data from 2 months ago to make decisions today. Two months ago, many said we'd prefer to go back in person, Rick says. Today seems very different in terms of the level of risk. Sarah, similar question. I've got, you know, friends who work in this school system as teachers and administrators, and they've said the amount of rancor in these public meetings as districts try to make the best decision is just really disheartening. And I wonder what you're seeing.
I'm seeing a similar, as Anya's saying, toxic uncertainty, as well as what feels for some people like an unsustainable amount of pressure on local decision makers, because not only is there really conflicting and often changing guidelines from the feds, it's also, you know, very intentionally pretty flexible from the state how schools reopen. As we may recall, in July, there was a 54-page document that came out of the governor's office for reopening. And it was intentionally very open-ended and didn't really mandate much, with the notion that, you know, a school in the North Country maybe should be reopening, whereas schools in the southern tier that are really close to Boston, that are suburban, may have much higher rates of infection and shouldn't open, and it should be really up to district leaders. But that variability, that flexibility, does mean that the battle is kind of happening at a district level. And it, and you know, your friends, Laura, are right in saying that the rancor is really high. I mean, some people have said that this really feels like it's tearing their community apart. There were already really intense battles over school budgets. I mean, New Hampshire is a place where, in many cases, the vast majority of the budget is paid for by local property taxes. So every year, you know, there's a big fight over the school budget. But now, you know, those lines are even starker. And there's a real sense that, you know, we have been relying on an institution and paying for an institution that is not even serving our kids anymore. So that's certainly something we're hearing from a lot of people who were already a little distrustful or frustrated with their school district. And then we hear from others that they don't feel safe sending their kids back to school. And they respect, you know, teachers' concerns about returning to school without proper PPE or social distancing or things like air filtration systems.
Yeah, I think I read just this morning, Sarah, that the Conway School District had a proposal in front of it to buy new air filtration systems, and they weren't sure if they were going to be exactly right. And so after a heated debate, they rejected that decision. But that was a tough one up in Conway. And those are the types of budgetary decisions that districts are trying to make. We got an email from Eric, since you both mentioned safety, who says, what accommodations are being made for older teachers and people at risk, say 60 years old and with an older spouse? Will they lose their jobs? And Anya, this has been something we've heard so much about in New Hampshire, and I wonder what you're hearing nationally. What accommodations are districts making for older teachers, Anya? And I know that's a big question because there's a lot of districts.
You know, most places, teachers who are in unions have a procedure for applying for medical exemptions from coming into the classroom. Now, there's some uncertainty in that process because it's an application and it may not automatically be granted. From what I've heard, you know, most teachers who have themselves underlying conditions are confident that they will not be forced into the classroom, that they'll be able to be assigned to teach remotely. And we have to, you know, the trend is going toward remote learning in you know, a preponderance of places around the country, although not so much in rural areas. That said, I think a concern that's hanging out there is family members. So when people who have, you know, they themselves might not be in a high risk category, but their partner is or someone in their home is. And that is not covered under a lot of agreements.
Oh, that's interesting, Anya. So nationally, most schools are going remote. Is that what you're seeing?
Outside of rural areas, there is a push towards remote, especially in larger urban districts where we see out of the top 10 urban, large urban districts, only New York City has planned to go in person. And that is under a huge amount of pressure right now.
I bet. I can imagine. So toward that end, here's an email from Steve, Anya, who says, is there any data to quantify what percentage of children are unsupervised by adults during virtual learning? I don't know if that data exists, Steve, but thank you for writing. And Anya, what can you tell us about that?
I think what we can see, the impacts on families are really wide ranging. I don't know specifically to the notion of how many kids are home alone, but we certainly see that parents are dropping out of the workforce, that those who are unemployed are not able to look for work. There's been a really worrying increase in child hunger, which has to do with a drop in income to families in particular. We see that parents of all class backgrounds and all races are really devoting as much time as they can to helping their kids with learning, even if they have to do that by after coming home, working a double shift and late at night. So there's a lot of commitment and a lot of passion by parents from all backgrounds in keeping their children learning, but it's certainly true that there are many that can't supervise them during the day.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're sitting down with two education reporters this hour about what they're seeing, what they're covering during this unprecedented back-to-school season. And we welcome your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Use Facebook or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Sarah, so Anya tells us that most districts in urban and suburban areas are going remote. Here in New Hampshire, lots of hybrid models and some full in person. What are districts planning, Sarah, to do if there is a case or cases at their school? One case versus five cases versus 10 cases. How are they shaking out that decision making, Sarah?
Sure. So we can go over that. But before we do, I think it's important to know that we don't yet have numbers on how many districts are staying remote versus hybrid versus fully in person. But the impression we have from early data, for instance, from the School Nurses Association and some anecdotal evidence, is that most schools in New Hampshire are going to be in a hybrid model, which does mean that kids are, going into the classroom, if not, 2 days a week, maybe three, but their teachers are often in school for the majority of the week. And so the state has really been sharpening its guidance on what to do if there's an outbreak, partially in response to a lot of criticism from school leaders that for a while, school leaders were having to kind of become epidemiologists and like figure out the latest CDC guidelines in addition to figuring out, how you actually reopen. So right now, the word is if there's a positive case, you immediately contact the local health officials. An outbreak may close down a school, and an outbreak is defined as three different clusters, and a cluster is three cases of the virus in the same classroom.
I see.
But really, that's becoming clearer. But the big question is, what to do with the unknown and the anxiety that maybe emerges if, say, there's a cluster in a different part of the district. There's a couple clusters or an outbreak in an elementary school. What happens with the high school where some of those kids' siblings are going? Should that also close? And state officials and school nurses are also saying that any symptom that a kid shows up with in school that's not attributed to existing conditions like asthma or allergies, that kid should be sent home and should get a COVID test before returning to school. So even if there's not an outbreak or a cluster per se, school nurses as well as parents and teachers are going to be constantly, kind of wrangling students and schedules to make sure that if a kid shows up with any kind of symptom, they're no longer in the building. And I think that's going to be a major concern, including for parents who think that they're dropping their kid off to school and won't have to deal with them or remote learning for the day and can go to work. It could be that in 2 hours, they're told they need to pick their kid up because their kid is coughing a little bit.
Wow. Yeah, it's going to be so hard. And I feel so fortunate that I'm able to work at home. I just don't know, Sarah, how parents who, work at a hospital or work in a restaurant, I don't even know how they're going to manage that.
Yeah, and there's certainly, we hear stories of people turning to neighbors and friends, or maybe their kind of pod that they've developed in their neighborhood over the course of the summer, where they say, I'm happy to have my kids' friends' parents pick them up. We've kind of come to an agreement that we can coordinate amongst ourselves if one of us is at work. So there certainly is, a sense that individuals on a neighborhood level or on a town level will come together to coordinate such that, a couple parents can go back to work. But certainly the stress on parents is extreme. And you see that playing out on social media every day. And you see that playing out in a lot of these school board meetings where, parents say not only where parents basically say, we can't stay home. It's impossible for us to stay home. And in a place like New Hampshire, where there's a pretty low prevalence of the virus, they say it's irresponsible for schools to be operating, remotely or even with a hybrid model, because many parents need to go back to work.
Right. Coming up, I want to ask you about that too, Anya. Pandemic pods, we've been hearing a lot about that. And we'll also hear from a reporter covering education in the Monadnock region. We'll find out what's going on there. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Hey, it's Lauren Chulgin, NHPR political reporter, and we are so thankful for our members who make NHPR's news reporting possible. That includes our comprehensive coverage of the coronavirus pandemic. If you're looking for another way to help, you can donate that vehicle you no longer need to us. We'll pick up your car, truck, or RV and invest the funds right back into the programming you rely on every day. Go online to nhpr.org/cardonation to learn more. And thanks so much.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with National and New Hampshire education reporters as they cover this year's unprecedented back-to-school season. We're with Anya Kamenetz of NPR and Sarah Gibson of NHPR. And with us now is Jack Rooney, education and business reporter at the Keene Sentinel. Welcome, Jack. Really nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
How many districts are you covering, Jack? And how many towns does that include? I think it's a lot.
It is. It's about 12 districts. Including our largest group of districts, New Hampshire School Administrative Unit 29, which includes Keene being the largest district and about six surrounding towns. So all told, close to 20 districts covering close to 40 towns here.
How much variety is there, Jack, in how all those schools in the district that you're covering, and kudos to you for that because it is a lot, how much variety is there in terms of what they're planning for the fall?
Well, district by district, there's certainly a lot of variety, but the big common theme across all of them is that they have, by and large, opted for some sort of hybrid model to reopen. And what those hybrid models look like differs depending on the district. Some are having students come in 2 days a week, 2 to 3 days a week. Some are having groups of students alternate being in class weekly, every other week. And so there is quite a variety in terms of these specific details of these hybrid reopening models. But for the most part, schools are opting for that hybrid model here.
Yeah, we talked to some administrators last week, including one, I think, from SAU 29, and it's dizzying the way these hybrid plans are arranged. We also talked, Jack, with Anya and Sarah about how hard it is to make these decisions, given the changing situation, given the pushback that certain decisions engender. In early August, Jack, you covered a 7-hour school board meeting for SAU 29. What was that like?
Yeah, that was really interesting because basically all six seven member districts of SAU 29, all of their school boards met at one time in the auditorium of Keene Middle School, with some people joining virtually and some audience in person, some audience online. And basically during that meeting, SAU 29 Superintendent Robert Millay walked through the SAU 29 reopening proposal, and which was the work of months of surveys and polling staff members and families, and presented that to the boards. And then the boards began making individual decisions at that meeting. Some accepted the plan as written, some delayed their decisions a little bit to tweak the hybrid model a little bit more. But really, it allowed these school board members, who are the ones who needed to be making these final decisions, to ask all of the questions they had, bring up any of the concerns, make sure that district administrators and leaders were taking things into consideration that were important to these school board members and from what they were hearing from community members.
Wow, 7 hours. Some districts, as you know, Jack, have been looking at New Hampshire's Virtual Learning Academy, or VLACs, as most people call it, to help with their remote learning. What conversations have you heard about that lately, about what's happening with VLACs?
Sure. Well, I know basically all of the districts in the Monadnock region and in the southwest portion of the state here are offering some sort of fully remote option for families who aren't comfortable sending back students at all, even under a hybrid model. And those remote options also vary from district to district. And several districts in this region were planning on, and some still are planning on, directing students who opt for this fully remote option to VLACs, which is an Exeter-based nonprofit online charter school. And from what I know, VLACs, the demand for their classes has exploded over the course of this summer as more and more New Hampshire families are looking for a fully online option, at least for this first semester of the school year. And that has led to wait lists for some of their classes. It's led them to hire dozens more staff members and try to add as many classes as they can in a short period of time. And so several districts are still sending specifically high school students who want a fully remote option to VLACs. A lot of the high school classes are still open. There's still some availability. But then some districts, like the districts in SAU 29, instead of dealing with the uncertainty maybe caused by some of the wait times for VLACs, have opted to just generate their own internal fully remote option staffed by SAU 29 staff members.
Right. Hard to figure that out, though, whether to wait for VLACs, Jack, or do your own program, given that those teachers are probably subscribed to teach someone in the classroom, too. So it's a lot to shake out. Just looking toward the fall, Jack, what in particular are you going to be following or looking for?
Sure. I think in the first couple of weeks of school, one of the biggest things that I'll be looking at is just how everyone is adjusting to this new normal. I think adjusting to hybrid models where students are in class a few days a week, but teachers are in classes 5 days a week, I think that's much like the spring. That's something no one has ever experienced before. And so a lot of these reopening plans have built into them time at the first couple of weeks of school, not necessarily focused on instruction as you would typically think of it, but on just helping students, especially the younger ones, adjust to this new routine, this new normal. And so that's something I'll be keeping a close eye on. And that goes hand in hand with also schools working really hard to assess gaps in learning that may have been caused in the spring when schools had to very quickly transition to fully remote instruction. And along with that, not only the instructional gaps maybe, but also the social emotional learning gaps that resulted from students just not being able to see their classmates, see their friends every day throughout the spring, and then perhaps through the summer here too. So I think those are, in terms of in-class instruction, those are some of the things I'll be looking at. And then, of course, the other thing that I think all reporters, education reporters, will be keeping a close eye on is if and when there is a confirmed case of COVID-19 in a school district, you know, when these plans basically have to be put into action, how well do they go? How capable are school districts going to be in terms of responding to a positive case or a positive, you know, an outbreak of positive cases?
Wow. Well, plenty for you to do, Jack. Thank you very much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Jack Rooney with the Keene Sentinel. And again, Exchange listeners, let's hear from you as we talk with education reporters covering this back-to-school season, all that they're seeing and hearing. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. What do you think is important for journalists to think about as they cover education this year? And what do you want them to understand about what's happening in your own particular district? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange at nhpr.org, and you can also use Facebook. And Sarah, to you first, please. So Jack mentioned what's going on with VLAX, the Virtual Learning Academy. This has been around for a long time. As he described, it's an online charter school where kids can enroll basically full-time or just take a class or two here and there. My son 1 year was struggling with Spanish, so he took a class in Spanish on VLAX, for example. What's happening now with VLAX, Sarah?
We're still waiting to see. So VLAX did expand in response to the pandemic at the request of DOE Commissioner Frank Edelblue. They expanded to include more courses and teachers for younger students with the expectation that there will have to be a remote option for some families. And it was originally billed as a way that, you know, schools could potentially generally go back to school for in person or with the hybrid model. But then for the kids who needed to learn or wanted to learn remotely, they could go to VLAX. But it's become a lot more complicated because, as Jack was saying, there's a really long wait list. The enrollment, I believe, has increased by about 150% in VLAX, and still the wait lists are really long, particularly for younger students. Some districts, such as Rochester, have had to totally reimagine what their remote option will look like because VLAX is not an option necessarily for their families as a result of the waitlist. But what we're hearing right now is that more teachers are being trained and onboarded with VLAX. And it'll be interesting to see what the total enrollment is, because the state pays for VLAX. So, you know, as we know, the state covers a certain kind of per pupil amount to each district, but it actually spends a lot more if that student decides to go to VLAX. And so there could be, you know, financial ramifications for the state if tons of students choose to opt for VLAX. The other thing that Jack said that I thought was really interesting about that Keene meeting is the extent to which, you know, they were turning to surveys of teachers and parents and then asking their own questions at the school board meeting. I've talked to superintendents who've basically said a survey is as good as the week that the survey was sent out. So if there's news that there was a new case, or if there's a lot of media, you know, hype about a new study that reveals that the viral load of children is actually really high, you know, we're constantly learning new things about the coronavirus from both a scientific and health guidance standpoint, as well as, you know, what the case amount is in our counties. And so, you know, a survey in July might not be very relevant in August. And that's part of what districts are struggling with so much, is that they think they're responding to the general kind of average consensus among teachers and parents. But that could have really changed and probably will change on a weekly basis.
Well, and speaking of remote and this virtual learning academy that you and Jack have described, Anya, I did want to ask you more about remote learning, because there is widespread recognition that despite enormous efforts, what schools did in the spring was not great, the best they could do under the circumstances, but not great. What do schools need, Anya, to make remote learning better this time around? And are they going to be able to do it?
I mean, the fundamental need is training and support for teachers. Online teaching is its own discipline. It has its own you know, strategies, and people have studied it for, you know, decades now, and there are techniques that any teacher can use to become more effective in their online learning. The idea of having this centralized academy with experience seems like a great option for people in New Hampshire, and I wish that we had it down here in New York as well, because, you know, with online learning, you have the opportunity to take advantage of economies of scale around planning curricula and even executing lesson planning when it comes to things like pre-taped lessons, for example, and then deploying your teaching staff to really work on the social and emotional aspect of teaching and to connect directly with students in smaller groups. So most of the online learning that's been very successful in the higher ed world really splits up their teaching staff. There are content experts who are really good at delivering the content. And then there are success coaches or academic coaches that are really, really good at connecting with students, which often has to happen one-on-one when you're working remotely. So thinking about the support, the training, but what we're also hearing is that there's just a lack of all of these things because school systems around the country are operating in a time of scarcity. There are, you know, there's cuts to budgets instead of increases in budgets. And, you know, I'm very alarmed by the idea that teachers are being asked to teach both remote and in-person at the same time. That doesn't seem something that's really ever been asked of teachers who are working at a high level. And it's going to be very, very hard to deliver quality instruction under those circumstances with no extra help or support.
Well, and speaking of remote learning, here's an email from Bob who says, Zoom is currently having a worldwide outage as lots of schools and colleges start classes. Bob says the reliance on one app may cause issues and people have to be ready for things like this. That being said, I totally support remote learning as it's not safe to be in classrooms yet at just 100% capacity. What about that, Anya? Everybody is relying on these technical infrastructures that we all kind of are crossing our fingers and hoping they won't crash, but they might.
So I have two things to say about that. You know, one is we can't overlook the fact that the technology infrastructure that we have put our remote learning on and our work is a bunch of big publicly traded companies, you know, and this is not public infrastructure that we're using right now. And that means there are concerns about privacy, there's concerns about advertising, potentially harassment, which Zoom had issues with when they first got started in the spring. So beyond sort of reliability issues, I think it's if we're going to be relying on online infrastructure to teach our public school students going forward, we really have to think about, do we want this to be in the hands of Silicon Valley executives, or do we want to build infrastructure that actually belongs to people?
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Jill writes, I am a middle school teacher. I have done everything that has been suggested as safe, not going out without a mask, ordering takeout, not going anyplace that has large gatherings. Jill says, I can tell you not all families have been doing this. To expose me and my fellow teachers to such large crowds all of a sudden would be the irresponsible thing. Our superintendent has chosen a remote model, and I still feel unsafe. And Jill, thank you. We talked to a group of teachers last week or the week before, and many of them were very concerned about being back in the classroom. Michelin writes, in Concord, there seems to be some subjectivity on decision-making by our school board. After voting to go 100% remote to the start, the very same board approves sports and extracurricular activities. This has caused an even greater divide among the community as to what's best overall. Michelin asks, what do your guests have to say about that discrepancy? Has any other school district decided to go remote, yet also involved in sports? And Michelin, thank you. And Sarah, what can you tell us about either the decision in Concord or just more broadly, how schools are deciding what to do academically and what to do with sports and extracurricular activities?
Yeah, that's a great question. I haven't yet heard of districts that are fully remote but are allowing sports, but that it could be that those exist. I certainly have heard confusion from school leaders because there were guidelines a couple of weeks ago that said, you know, school fall sports can resume with certain safety guidelines. But then we heard from state health officials, including Dr. Chan, that, you know, high contact sports like football and even soccer, wrestling should really be discouraged. So I've heard more of hybrid, you know, schools that have determined a hybrid model is safe. deciding that that high contact sports are probably not going to work for them. Again, it does depend on the region. So I think it'll be interesting to see to what extent sports are allowed in the northern part of the state, where people are resuming a little bit more back to normal and where cases are extremely low. But that's something that a lot of superintendents are still making decisions about now.
Well, and a perfect segue to who we're going to talk to after a short break. We'll talk with longtime Berlin reporter Barbara Tetreault about what's been happening with schools in Berlin and sports. Very important in that region. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Chances are, you're working from home a lot more these days. Hi, I'm Sam Evans Brown, host of Outside In, and if you're like me, you're driving much less. And perhaps you're wondering what to do with that old vehicle you no longer need. Well, you can donate it to NHPR and turn those many miles into shows that you love, like Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Outside In. We'll take care of the paperwork and arrange to have it picked up for free at nhpr.org/car donation.
This is The Exchange. This hour, we're talking with education reporters about what they're hearing as they cover this difficult back-to-school season. Our guests are NHPR's Sarah Gibson and NPR's Anya Kamenetz. And with us now is Barbara Tetreault, managing editor at the Berlin Sun. Barbara, welcome back. Really nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
How many different districts are you covering, Barbara, and how many cities and towns does that include?
Well, we cover the Anascaga Valley, so that's two SAUs, probably about eight towns. But I also sort of keep track of the other three SAUs in a county, and that would probably be about 20 towns.
Wow. And how much variety is there in the North Country, Barbara, in terms of how schools are planning for the fall?
There's a little bit, but most of them are heavy on in school, as you might imagine, because the coronavirus has been, rates have been low here. So all of them are offering some form of remote, although for some of them, the remote is only if you have a medical reason. Mm-hmm. But Berlin, for example, is by parental choice. The parents got to choose whether they wanted in school or hybrid or remote. And about 30% selected remote.
Wow.
So far.
So who's providing the virtual learning or the remote learning, Barbara?
I believe they're doing it themselves. They're using Google Classroom. One school district is using virtual learning academy.
Right, which we talked about, right. What are you hearing as you cover this story, Barbara, from parents and families and students in your district? How are people in the North Country feeling right now about this?
I think that people are, you know, education is important here. I mean, it's one of the things that the communities really seem to focus on. So they are concerned about, you know, our students getting a full and quality education during this crisis. And, you know, we've had 4 months of remote learning, and even coming back in class, we have reduced class time, fewer social interactions for students. They're not getting the socialization. Plus, there's a loss of many of the traditions that kind of bond us as when we're in our school years. Homecoming, no homecoming, no prom. Most of them had graduations that were limited. And those are sort of the memories you make of your school years.
Sure. So well, turning out for the high school football team, another big tradition, not just in the North Country, but everywhere. What's the plan for sports in Berlin, for example, Barbara?
They're working on a sports season that will... They don't have football here, but they do have soccer and a field hockey. And they have put in some strict protocols. The main thing I think they're trying to do is to do a more regionalized schedule instead of Berlin going to play schools in the southern and central part of the state. They're going to try and focus more on the North Country, even though it might not be as challenging competition-wise. But, you know, they're trying to transportation, have parents help. Kids won't be using locker rooms. They'll come to their school the day dressed in their uniforms. They'll have wash stations at the game. Every time they come in or out of the game, they'll wash. And they'll wear these neck gaiters, not when they're playing, but when they come in and off the field.
When they're on the sidelines, sure. I had heard, Barbara, correct me if I'm wrong, please, that a lot of families in your region are homeschooling. Is that right?
There are a lot of homeschoolers for a school Berlin size. I think last year there were 98 students that were homeschooled compared to out of a total enrollment of about 1,100. And some of those are religious schools that curriculums that people are using, or it's a concern, I think, for the school, because they don't get to approve curriculums for home students. They don't really have any control except they register with them. They have to register.
Is there a thought that more families might choose the homeschooling option, given that, you know, a reasonable number are already doing it?
I would think they would use the remote, because then they get the curriculums and they're more part of the school environment.
How has the North Country's economic situation, Barbara, been playing into these reopening decisions? And as you told us earlier, most schools in your region are going fully open.
With an option for remote.
Sure.
Right now, I think the financial components are okay, because there's been money from CARES grant and other. I know that Berlin got about $600,000 from the CARES grant, and they've hired an additional teacher, some additional paraprofessionals, additional monitors. But the worry is, you know, next year's budget, when the economic impacts will have accumulated, and will that money still be available? And what is the state going to do with school funding?
Yeah. All right, Barbara, thank you very much for being with us. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Barbara Tatro with the Berlin Daily Sun. One more time, our email exchange at nhpr.org and our phone number 1-800-892-6477. And Sarah, can you talk about homeschooling, private schools, you know, some families just saying, I can't deal with hybrid or virtual. I need another choice. What are you hearing there?
Sure. So anecdotally, there is a huge surge in interest in homeschooling. We have seen just kind of through the roof traffic on websites for organizations that are kind of the go-to places for New Hampshire parents who want to homeschool. So the New Hampshire Homeschooling Coalition and Granite State Home Educators. Both of them are saying that they've never gotten this many inquiries about how to basically start a pod or homeschool your kids for a year, if not longer. We won't have numbers on this until later on. As Barbara was saying, if you're a first-time homeschooler, you inform you have a couple of options of who to inform. It could be the district or the DOE directly. But basically, what it means is that by the end of this fall semester, we'll have enrollment numbers for all districts, and we'll probably see in some places an increase in homeschooling in reaction to, you know, concerns not only about safety but about all of the kind of variability. So it being really hard to establish a routine. So even if parents feel like maybe it's safe to go back, they're concerned that if there's an outbreak, then their kid would be remote for 2 weeks, or there would be, you know, limitations because of all the mask wearing. It'd be hard to understand the teacher. You know, I've just heard a number of different concerns from parents who say, I want more control over how this year goes for my kids, so I'm going to homeschool. We're also seeing a really big spike in interest as well as enrollment in private schools in New Hampshire. The Catholic diocese, in fact, did a whole incentive program this summer to attract new families with tuition discounts. So a lot of Catholic schools have not only really long wait lists, but also an increase in enrollment. Again, we'll see those numbers more clearly later this fall. But I think it's fair to say that a lot of families are looking for alternatives outside of the public school system this year. And it's, you know, it's just going to be a matter of time for us to understand to what extent that changes the landscape of public education in a longer term way.
Wow. Anya, I'd love to hear what you're looking at as well.
Well, certainly we see these potentially being national trends. You know, historically, the levels of people in private schools have been very low, around 1 in 10, as well as about no more than about 3% that homeschool. So even a small movement could have a really outsized impact, especially if you look at the idea that it's going to be families with more means, those that are able to work from home, for example, that are able to take advantage of those options. And, you know, if we don't kind of bail out the public school system and reinvest in creating quality experiences for students across the country, I think the danger, obviously, that we're looking at is the loss of a central American institution where people from all backgrounds come together. You know, it doesn't have to be a large group of people who stop using the public schools for them to kind of fade into the background as far as having priority in thinking about how to create a better future for all the children.
Wow. So more divides, Anya, between the education haves and have-nots that we already see.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, we see across the spectrum from poverty to housing, how and healthcare itself, how the pandemic really exacerbates what's already out there.
You know, Anya, back in May and June, as you know, many young people participated in racial justice protests, and this continues to be an important issue for many students. Anya, where does this concern stand right now within this wider work of trying to go back to school? There's sort of two giant social, emotional trends affecting our country right now.
Yes, that's right. You know, I think it's a really massive question. I'm glad that you asked about that because, first of all, there are these sort of insoluble tensions where families are trying to decide what is the equitable solution for myself, for my child, to create some stability for them. On the second round, you know, what I hear from a lot of teachers is, you know, they really are responsible for having their children, the children that they teach, feel like they are citizens of this country, that they have a stake in the future of this country, and that they are not forgotten. And it's very, very hard to convey to children of color growing up in this country right now that they have hope and that there is something good for their future. There's just so many kids who have been, you know, either out in the streets themselves or watching what's been happening with police violence and feel very abandoned, and then abandoned again when it comes to schools not being able to reopen or not reopening fully or not having, you know, the resources and the services that their families have depended on, from meals to healthcare to mental health that schools across the country provide. And so teachers are really feeling a lot of despair as they try to convey a message of care to their students in the face of, you know, so many messages coming from outside that they're as young people, that their generation is not being really supported.
Yeah, Anya, hard to transmit that message of care sometimes over a screen. You try, but I just wonder about that.
It is really difficult. It's something that a lot of teachers I know are having stress about, that you know, they know that what they have a duty of care that's part of their jobs, and over a screen, it's very hard, especially when, you know, the kids under the most stress and pressure are the ones that have the hardest time connecting again.
Right, with some of those technological disparities that we talked about. Very quickly, if I could ask both of you, we heard the Democratic National Convention last week, a lot of talk about education. I'm sure we'll hear about it at the Republican National Convention this week. Sarah, a more local question, though. How much is education and all this disruption that we're seeing playing a role in our upcoming elections here in New Hampshire?
Well, both Democratic gubernatorial candidates for the primary, Walensky and Feltes, have said, you know, they have really drawn attention to the school reopening in New Hampshire as an example of failed leadership, they say, of Governor Sununu. They say the guidelines were not strict enough. They led to a lot of, you know, anxiety as well as frustrations and, frankly, pretty substantial financial costs. For schools that are looking at reopening, maybe without proper PPE, maybe without you know, proper filtration systems, and with a lot of really nervous teachers. So they're certainly making it central to their message about why New Hampshire needs a change in leadership. And we've heard also a critique of Governor Sununu's reopening plans from other Democrats as well. But going back to this question of racial justice and racial equity, I mean, I think that is going to play into the election in a variety of ways, both in terms of questions about education as well as just larger kind of accountability questions for the state. So we're certainly seeing here that there's a very, very disproportionate impact of the coronavirus on people of color, particularly Black women in New Hampshire. And, you know, there have been real calls by Black Lives Matter chapters here in New Hampshire, both to address racial disparity in education and to address disparity in law enforcement. And those are kind of dual messages that racial justice advocates and activists here in New Hampshire are pushing. And they're really asking for responses to both those queries when they're talking to elected officials. So I think we'll hear both about educational equity as well as larger racial equity questions from those activists in the coming months.
Wow. Well, Sarah, no shortage of things you need to keep track of as our education reporter. Good luck as you cover this rollout of school reopening in the fall. Thank you, Sarah, for being with us.
You're welcome, Maura.
And Anya, again, plenty to keep you busy. Thank you very much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Anya Kamenetz, education correspondent at NPR. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.